Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're diving into a topic that's particularly close to my heart. Food.
And not just any food, but the so-called Viking pan, a modern term for Nordic food culture. A fascinating window into the past.
What I find so appealing about it, Viking cuisine was essentially, well, how do you put it? Pragmatic? Regional? Seasonal? Making the best of what was available.
Exactly, and under pretty harsh conditions. Scandinavia in the early medieval period was no land of plenty. They had to be clever with their resources.
That's something you also know from modern camp life. When you're cooking over an open fire, you think carefully about what you bring and how you prepare it. Nothing goes to waste.
Although we need to be careful. When we talk about the Vikings, we're not talking about a homogeneous group. These were different tribes, regions, traditions. A Viking in Norway ate differently than one in Denmark or Iceland.
Local resources determined the cooking. More fish on the coast, more game and livestock inland. That's naturally reflected in the dishes.
But what was the same everywhere was
the importance of sharing meals together.
That's exactly what I was about to say. That was central to the Norse peoples, not just consuming food, but genuine social events.
The longhouses had these large communal spaces. People sat together, ate, drank, told stories. Food was the glue that held the community together.
And what we call Viking pan today is a modern interpretation. But it embodies exactly that: simple, seasonal ingredients. Historically, there's no fixed dish with that name on record. Meat, fish, vegetables, whatever the season and region provided.
What I find interesting, they also preserved a lot of food. Smoking, drying, salting. Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived the long winter.
Right, they wouldn't have made it through otherwise. And these techniques also shaped the flavor. Smoked fish, cured meat. That wasn't just practical, it defined Nordic cuisine.
In reenactment, we try to recreate that experience. Cooking over a campfire, using ingredients and methods that are as authentic as possible. That's when you realize how much knowledge is behind it. It's not just throwing things on the fire.
And that's exactly what makes the Viking pan so interesting. As a modern interpretation, it shows how people cooked with simple means back then. A glimpse into the daily lives of people from over 1,000 years ago.
There's so much to it. From the ingredients, to the cooking techniques, to the social significance. It's worth taking a closer look. Let's take a closer look at what actually ended up on the table for the Norse peoples. And I have to say, the variety was impressive, considering the harsh conditions.
Fish was of course central, especially for coastal communities. Herring and salmon were among the main protein sources. Cod was also commonly served.
And when it came to meat, they had a wide selection. Pork, beef, sheep, goat, plus game from hunting. Livestock farming was well established, but varied by region.
Absolutely. That underscores this point about regional adaptation. Such a variety of meat and dairy products wasn't something you'd find everywhere.
Dairy farming was actually quite developed. Cheese, butter, these were regularly produced and consumed. And honey as a sweetener was precious.
Mainly for meat, right?
Amongst Lichtempo. Butter is very family as a scritter. And honey as a vita, amongst before these work.
Mainly for meat, right?
amongst Lichtempo. Butter is very family as a Skritte, and honey as a Vita, amongst before these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Amongst Lichtempo. Butter is very family as a Skritte, and honey as a Vita, amongst before these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Amongst Lichtempo. Butter is very family as a Skritte, and honey as a Vita, amongst before these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Amongst Lichtempo. Butter is very family as a Skritte, and honey as a Vita, amongst before these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Amongst Lichtempo. Butter is very family as a Skritte, and honey as a Vita, amongst before these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Mainly for mead as a Skritte. Please, for the morning, between the morning work on.
Mainly for mead, right?
Menalis Nimlingsdexter, if these anything about him, before anything about a many where these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Mainly is Skritte. These are closed and grow and campanation, so is one by diacarate. Promote information between a talent heat and slart and load, and from the obber these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Mainly is these alonged between the morning work on.
Mainly for mead, right?
Mainly as these are closed, if these anything about him, before anything about a many word these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Mainly as these are closed, if these anything about him, between the morning work on.
Mainly for mead, right?
Mainly as these are closed, if these anything about him, before anything about a many word these work.
Mainly for mead, right?
Among other things, but also for sweetening food in general. There was no sugar, honey was the main sweetener. Besides that, they also used berries, reduced fruit juices, or malt, depending on the season.
As for grains, barley, oats, and rye were the main ones. Wheat was harder to grow in the Scandinavian climate. The grain was made into bread or eaten as porridge.
And then all the wild plants and berries. That's often underestimated. They were important sources of vitamins, especially in summer and autumn. They were gathered and supplemented the diet.
Amazing how balanced it actually was. By the way, if you enjoy these insights into history, feel free to leave a like or subscribe to the channel. That helps us produce more episodes like this.
But let's come back to the preservation methods you mentioned earlier. Those were absolutely essential for survival.
Without them, they wouldn't have survived the long winters.
Exactly. They wouldn't have made it otherwise. Drying, smoking, salting, and also fermenting. These were the most important techniques. Fish and meat were preserved this way, sometimes for months.
And for sea voyages, this was essential. When you're at sea for weeks, you need provisions that won't spoil. Dried fish, stockfish for example, was perfect for that.
In today's reenactment, we try to
recreate that. Though with modern hygiene standards, it sometimes gets, well, tricky.
You have to find compromises. Only a few people do real smoking over several days. But understanding and demonstrating the principle, that works well. And the taste of properly smoked fish is simply different from what you get at the supermarket.
The seasonings are also interesting. Much of it could be gathered wild. Dill, caraway, mustard, and probably wild thyme too. Although honestly, with some herbs we don't know for sure if they were actually used, archaeologically we mainly find grains and legumes.
And that's a fascinating point. Some spices were genuine luxury goods that had to be traded over great distances, while others grew right outside the door. That naturally made a big difference in who could use what.
This also shows the trade connections of the Norse peoples. The idea that they sat isolated in Scandinavia is simply wrong.
As for vegetables, they had cabbage, turnips, onions, plus beans and peas. Everything that thrives in the Nordic climate and stores well. Robust stuff, basically.
Their entire diet was focused on sustainability and stockpiling. Nothing was wasted, everything had its purpose.
And these principles, eating seasonally, sourcing locally, preserving food, are actually experiencing a renaissance. Maybe we really can learn something from the ancient Scandinavians.
And as we said at the beginning, eating was never just about nutrition, but always a central social event.
Sharing meals was firmly anchored in daily life. These communities lived closely together, and the shared meal was the moment when everyone came together.
For special occasions, this was taken to another level. Weddings, harvest festivals, religious ceremonies, there were proper banquets. Feasts with abundant food on the table.
And hosting guests was a status symbol. Whoever set a generous table demonstrated wealth and good connections. Hospitality was, well, almost an obligation, you could say.
A matter of honor. Anyone who hosted guests poorly lost respect. This applied across all social classes.
And the place for these gatherings was, of course, the longhouse.
When it comes to longhouses, you have to imagine these weren't small.
Exactly. These weren't huts. We're talking about buildings 20, 30 meters long.
Archaeological finds show enormous variations. Typically, they were about 20 meters long and 7 meters wide. But at Trelleborg, the famous Viking fortress, longhouses of nearly 30 meters have been excavated. They were divided into three sections, a large central hall of 18 by 8 meters and two smaller rooms at the gable ends.
And at Herdeby, right here in Schleswig-Holstein, there are reconstructed houses you can visit. The larger houses there had around 200 square meters, quite impressive for a townhouse in a trading center.
A longhouse typically housed 10 to 30 people under one roof. 50 only in large elite longhouses. Several generations of a family, sometimes servants as well, all together.
Just imagine, 20, 30 people eating, sleeping, working together. Privacy was a foreign concept.
The large communal room in the center was the heart of the home. That's where the central hearth stood, where cooking happened, where people gathered. It was, how should I put it, something like a, no, not a living room, more like the social hub of the entire household.
And this tradition of eating together lives on. At medieval fairs, at LARP events, the communal meal by the campfire is often the highlight. That's where conversations and connections happen that
wouldn't happen otherwise.
Yes. It's amazing how universal this is. People come together, share food, tell stories. It worked the same way 1,000 years ago as it does today.
The Vikings understood this. Food was communication, community, identity. The quality of the dishes mattered, but being together was just as important.
That's why herbs and spices were carefully selected. That's why time was invested in preparation. It was about offering something good to guests and family.
In a way, this reflects our modern longing for genuine connection. Away from quick meals on the go, toward mindful, shared dining.
And that's exactly what makes Viking food culture so fascinating. It reminds us that eating can be more than just consuming calories. When it comes to seasonings, we need to distinguish between what grew locally and what came through trade.
they had quite a bit available in their own gardens.
The classic herbs?
Dill, fennel, plus caraway and mustard. These were picked fresh from the garden or gathered wild and used directly. All things that thrive in the Scandinavian climate. And interestingly, many of them also had medicinal uses. The boundaries were fluid.
There was no separation back then. Kitchen and medicine went hand in hand. Dill, for example, was used both for seasoning and for digestive issues.
And this fluid transition from kitchen to medicine also applied to vegetables. Many of the robust varieties that stored well also had health benefits.
Practicality came first. What grows here, what keeps for a long time, that's how selections were made.
When it comes to imported spices, things get...
Exactly, really exciting. That's where the trade routes come into play.
And when it comes to imports, pepper is of course the prime example.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Pepper, for instance, originally came from India. The route to Scandinavia went through the Byzantine Empire or via Arab traders. The Vikings used their eastern river routes, down the Volga to the Caspian Sea or down the Dnieper to Constantinople.
Furs, honey and amber were traded for these exotic spices.
In Hedebü, the major trading center here in Schleswig-Holstein, Arabic silver coins have been found. That shows how far these trading networks reached.
Pepper, as I said, a real luxury good that was valued among elites as a precious trade item, though payment was more commonly in silver. Using pepper as currency actually came later in the High Middle Ages.
That sounds surprising at first, but when you consider the effort involved in transportation, the price was correspondingly high.
Caraway and mustard seeds were much easier to obtain. They actually grew locally. Caraway even grew wild, and mustard had been cultivated since the Iron Age. Both have been found in Birka and Hedebü. They were mainly used in meat dishes and stews, a perfect flavor match for the hearty meats.
These spices didn't just enhance the dishes, they also...
Right, they even helped with preservation. Mustard, for example, has antimicrobial properties.
They knew this intuitively, even without modern science.
What fascinates me, many of these herbs are still typical of Scandinavian cuisine today. Dill with salmon is practically a classic. This tradition has held for over 1,000 years.
Some combinations just work so well that they endure for generations.
And this shows how sophisticated this cuisine was. Not primitive, but adapted to climate, availability, and taste. They made the best of what they had and supplemented it strategically through trade.
The cooking techniques of the Norse peoples were remarkably diverse. The open fire was, of course, the main method. Practical, effective, and it gave the food that characteristic smoky flavor.
A certain smoky taste was often part of it, varying in intensity depending on the setup. That just came with cooking over an open fire. And the advantage? You could prepare large quantities at once, perfect for communal meals.
What has always fascinated me are the earth ovens. The technique is, how should I describe it, a kind of natural slow cooker.
You mean those pits with hot stones?
Exactly. You dig a hole in the ground, line it with heated stones, put the food in, usually larger pieces of meat or root vegetables, and cover everything with earth. It then cooks for hours at a consistent temperature.
This method is actually found worldwide. In Polynesia, among the Maori, among indigenous peoples of the Americas, the principle is universal. People independently discovered the same solution.
Which shows how effective it is. The heat stays constant, the meat becomes butter tender, and the energy required is minimal once the stones are hot.
In reenactment, this is one of the more exciting techniques to recreate. It takes time, but the results are impressive. And it doesn't get more authentic than that.
Smoking was the third major method, and interestingly, it combines cooking with preservation. Smoking was usually done directly in the longhouse. The smoke from the central hearth rose up into the roof structure, where meat and fish were hung.
Whatever was available was used. Birch, oak, spruce. Whether they already selected woods specifically for flavour back then, we don't know for certain. The typical juniper aromas we know today, those are actually later traditions.
When it comes to the tools and utensils.
Absolutely. The iron cauldron was the centerpiece.
It was hung over the fire and was incredibly versatile. Stews, soups, porridge, everything was prepared in it.
These cauldrons were solidly built, had to withstand a lot. And then all the wooden utensils, spoons for stirring, bowls and plates. Wood was the standard material, readily available and easy to work with.
For smoking, you needed special racks and hooks to hang the meat. Usually made of metal or sturdy wood, had to be able to bear the weight.
And in earth ovens, the food was often placed directly on the hot stones, or wrapped in leaves or cloth, especially meat and root vegetables. The stones retained the heat and cooked everything slowly and evenly.
What stands out? Everything was designed for durability and...
And everything was designed for practicality.
No unnecessary frills. Every tool had its purpose and was passed down through generations.
In today's living history, we try to replicate exactly these utensils. A good iron cauldron over an open fire, that completely transforms the cooking experience. Suddenly you understand why certain dishes were prepared this way.
The technique dictates the flavor. The open fire, the smoke, the slow heat of the earth oven. You can't simply replicate that with modern methods.
And that's exactly what makes these old cooking techniques so valuable. They're not just history. They still work today.
If we sum all this up, the Viking pan is really more than just a dish.
It's a window into another time. The ingredients, the techniques, the way food was cooked and eaten. It all connects and tells a story.
A story of people who made the best of what they had under difficult conditions. Regional, seasonal, practical, but still with care and, well, with real skill.
And the communal aspect runs through everything. The large longhouses, the feasts, sharing by the fire. Eating was never just about nutrition, but always also...
Connection, exactly, between people and between generations.
That's perhaps the most timeless aspect. We still enjoy sitting together today, cooking together, sharing meals. That need has remained.
And for anyone who wants to experience this firsthand, at a medieval fair, at a reenactment event, or simply at your own campfire, you'll quickly notice how different food feels when you prepare it this way.
The smoky flavor, the slowness, waiting for the earth oven. It completely changes your perception. Suddenly you understand why certain combinations work.
For everyone who wants to dive deeper, at battlemerchant.com you'll find suitable utensils and the blog has many more topics for history enthusiasts.
The great thing is, you don't have to be an expert to get started. A cauldron, an open fire, a few traditional ingredients, and you're right in the middle of it.
The Norse peoples would probably be pleased to see that their culinary traditions live on.
With that in mind, thank you so much for listening.
Until next time, and bon appetit on your own culinary journeys through time.
Bye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.